These folks at CKUT love their 100% certified organic and fair trade gourmet coffee from Saint-Tropez. Prepared in the heart of Montreal with beans from all over the world, you can find and get your own cup of freshly brewed Saint-Tropez coffee from AUS Snacks on McGill Campus or from Café Saint-Tropez on the corner of Saint-Urbain and Duluth.
I need a fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh cappuccino.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Amandla, your weekly bilingual news show with briefings and analysis from the continent of Africa. We're here every week, Wednesday at 7 o'clock till 8 at CKUT 90.3 FM on your dial. And of course, we have our website, amandla.ca, where you can follow up with the details and full length of the shows repeated there. So tonight, we have a full evening. Gwen, actually, you've pulled it together for us, and COVID's on the agenda.
Yes, it is indeed. We are devoting the entire show to that. So I had the opportunity to talk to Ismail Rashid, who's a professor of African history at Vassar College in the US and a longtime friend and contributor here on Amandla. And we take a look at the rising tide of vaccine nationalism and its implications for Africa. And then we return to Feroz Manji's series, Organizing in the Time of COVID, and his interview with a Zimbabwean epidemiologist, Dr. Renee Lowenson, and they explore the question of what do we know about COVID-19 spread in Africa. It's a great show, so please stay tuned to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3.
That was that piece that you're going to do with Rashid sounds like a really great follow-up on what I talked about last week with vaccine apartheid. Tell us more about your talk with Rashid.
Yeah, well, I wanted to follow up with Rashid because, as I said in the introduction, he's a historian. With one of his specialties is the history of medicine and health in Africa. We actually did our graduate studies together at McGill University, and Rashid for a while was an active direct contributor to Amandla until he moved down to New York, where he now teaches at Vassar College. So one of the books that he's published is Understanding West Africa's Ebola Epidemic Towards a Political Economy, and also published a paper, Epidemics and Resistance in Sierra Sierra Leone during the First World War. So Rashid is a great guy to talk to about providing some broader context when it comes to epidemic, pandemic, the fact that he's from Sierra Leone and Sierra Leone's experience with Ebola also helps to broaden out the discussion around the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is the second time I've spoken to Rashid since the onset of the pandemic. And what we talked about this time was the rise of vaccine nationalism and what that means for Africa. So here's our discussion. Hi, Rashid. Welcome back to Amandla.
Thank you very much, Gwen, for having me on Amandla again.
It's always good to have you with us. So listen, at the last time we spoke, which was a few months ago, we focused on your home country of Sierra Leone. And at the time, numbers were low and people were handling the situation relatively well, having learned the discipline of living in a pandemic with their experience with the much more virulent Ebola. So let's just start with, what does the situation look like in Sierra Leone now?
So Sierra Leone, like many countries in Africa, and also like North America and Europe, suffered from the Christmas holiday or the winter holiday spike. A lot of Sierra Leoneans who were living abroad, especially in North America and Europe, traveled back to Sierra Leone for the holidays. They wanted warm weather, they wanted to see family, and they wanted to have a good time. And the consequence of that was that Sierra Leone came out of the holiday season, like the United States, like parts of Europe, with just a large bump in the COVID cases. And that led the government to once more reinstitute a curfew. They also increased a campaign around the preventive measures that people should take to prevent themselves from spread of COVID. So the bottom line was that we had the spike. So far, the numbers seem to be holding relatively steady. They went up, they seem to be holding relatively stable. My sense is that hopefully they will begin to go down in response to those measures.
What are the death rates looking like?
Surprisingly, the number of people dying are not so high, because the last time I checked, I think was still under the 200 people death rate. Okay. In terms of numbers of people dying. So the number of people dying are not very high.
And the population of Sierra Leone is
about 7 million. Okay. Yeah, so the numbers are still relatively low. The number of infected people since the start of the pandemic to now is also not very high. I think we're still under roughly about 2,000 people, infected people. So the numbers are still very good. And people do take the measures very seriously. There have been sort of a positive response to the curfew that the government imposed. People still sort of following the guidelines, although there's still a lot of lackadaisical attitudes towards these measures.
Well, for comparative purposes, Quebec has a similar overall population to Sierra Leone, and we just passed the 10,000 lives lost mark last week or the week before.
I'm sorry to hear that. It's
quite a dramatic difference. Look, I want to talk to you about vaccinations. I have a few numbers here. So as of last week, North America was leading with 6% of the population having been vaccinated, followed by Europe at 3.6%. Then it drops precipitously to 0.9% in Asia, 0.7% in South America, and a very dramatic less than 0.1% for Africa. What's going on here?
In terms of the
availability of, well, it seems like the essentially non-availability of the vaccine in Africa.
Oh, so You know, just following the vaccine story, my short and quick response is what it has revealed. It has revealed the unequal structure of the globe in terms of always what we've known of the differences between the countries of the Northern Hemisphere and the countries of the Southern Hemisphere. As at now, in terms of vaccine availability, as at now, South Africa was one of the few countries which received about a million plus vaccine. But Gwen, you know that most of that vaccine now in South Africa, which was the AstraZeneca vaccine, is unusable in South Africa because of the South African, the new South African COVID variant. It's unusable. So which means that the South Africans have to go out and hopefully source for vaccine that is usable. Algeria got a good batch of vaccine. I think they got about 200,000 vaccine sometime in January. So one of the few African countries which were able to source out and get a lot of vaccine.
The other two are Seychelles and Morocco. I think that
exactly. So I wanted to mention those two countries. Once you get beyond those countries, is what you have are really two scenarios. So one is this upbeat scenario that African countries through AVAT, which is an African vaccination team, and through COVAX, have been able to secure something like 600 million doses.
Tell our listeners what COVAX is.
Okay, so COVAX is the group that was put together by WHO, in which a number of countries around the world, including Canada, but also a lot of developing countries, join in so that there will be an equitable distribution of the vaccine. So that's COVAX. So the good news is for Africa is that they have sourced out and they are expecting that there would be something like 600 million plus vaccine doses available. So that's the good news. The challenging news is that from that purchase or from those anticipated purchases, the earliest that would be available, that some of that vaccine would be available to many African countries would be late February and early March. So the majority of African countries are in a position where they haven't even seen the first dose of vaccines. Yeah. We can talk later about, so even when the vaccines are coming in or when the vaccines do come in, what are the other challenges and problems that would be available. So the first challenge that the continent is facing insofar as vaccination is concerned is just simply access and availability.
Yeah, well, there's a little sad PS to this, is that Canada, which is, I think, the second largest donor country to COVAX, has claimed 1.9 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine from COVAX. Apparently, it's entitled to, even though those vaccines are supposed to be designated for Africa and other parts of the world that are less able to afford it. Canada is now claiming 1.9 million doses out of that because we're having a very slow rollout of the vaccination campaigns here, having trouble accessing them. So sadly, Canada's kind of carving away at some of that supply, which could have a direct impact for the numbers of vaccinations that will, of doses that will be available to Africa.
Yeah, so that's, Gwen, that's one of the issues. So Canada, I mean, the news that circulated last week, as you're very aware of, was that, Canada already has purchased or has claimed access to or has bargained for up to nine times what it actually needs. Yeah. The northern or western countries in general have claimed, bought, purchased, or made advance claims for up to three times what they actually need.
Yeah.
So all of that discussion, all of that talk especially from WHO, that they were going to make sure that given that the pandemic was a global phenomenon, that there was going to be some kind of global awareness in rolling out the vaccination. Mm-hmm. That has not happened. We've seen a lot of what's called vaccine nationalism. But what we've also seen, to be honest, is the way capitalism works. So the countries with the most resources, the countries with the nearest access or the most access to the big pharma, and the countries where the production have been located are the countries which have been ahead of the queue, which have purchased the most doses, and which are the countries where the rollout has started initially. They've all had different problems in terms of rolling out the vaccine, but the bottom line is that the richer, the wealthier countries have more or less claimed first access to. They've got the most vaccine. And these are the countries where people have started accessing the vaccine more than places like Africa or other developing countries.
Well, I'm going to hammer home that point with a few more numbers here. So exactly what you were saying, Rashid, Canada has ordered 123.8 million doses, which is more than 330% of our population here in Canada. The UK has ordered more than 201 million doses, which is about 302% of its population. And the United States has ordered enough for 169% of its population. So the inequity that you're pointing to, there it is in numbers. It's pretty striking.
Yes, and you know, all of those considerations about so how do we think fairly of how we roll out this vaccination? Who are the people who, regardless of location, regardless of where they live geographically, would probably be at the top of the line to get access to this vaccine? I think all of that has been lost in the national debates, mm-hmm. because in different countries, the issue is not so much taking into consideration demography or vulnerability. The issue has been is that people want their countries or their nations in particular to be the ones to first, quote unquote, reach herd immunity, which is getting around 70% of your population immunized from the vaccine. And that has created a lot of problems. So all of that, most of that global thinking has gone out of the window. What we're now engaged in is really a competition, a rush for different countries to get as many of their population vaccinated or immunized as possible. And you know this, Gwen, that's not going to work. In a world where people move around, that's not going to work. One country achieving herd immunity or one country getting most of its population vaccinated or immunized is not going to radically change things globally if we don't get to a position where the majority of the world's population gets immunized. So.
No, it's remarkably short-sighted, and I would not be surprised if electoral politics is playing a very strong role, because these governments want to be reelected. So there's also the race to get those get their populations vaccinated so that they enjoy the popularity they need for re-election.
I agree with you. I mean, there's a sense in which even as the pandemic was unfolding, we began to see elements of really what one could call disease of pandemic nationalism. In the United States, we had a president who was unwilling, who did not support having any kind of strong international effort around the vaccine.
Quite to the contrary, undermined the World Health Organization at a critical time in the pandemic.
Exactly. And on the European side, look at what was going on with the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe. In the middle of the pandemic, the United Kingdom was trying to separate, was separating from Europe. And there was a bit of gloating on the part of the United Kingdom in saying that, look, see what we've been able to achieve once we're out of Brexit. Look at what's happening in Europe. showing that Europe doesn't work, it was a good idea for us to move out of the off Europe in the first place. But that the main point here to underline, as you're saying, Gwen, is this sense in which what the world needs most, which is wrapping our heads around a global pandemic, finding a strategy that works for us globally, has become, as you rightly said, hostage to national electoral politics, and to short-term, political gains.
And I guess profit motive too for the pharmaceutical companies, as you pointed out or alluded to, capitalism has a big role to play in all of this. And we don't really know, the prices of the doses range from something like $10 up to $60 or $70 per dose. I would presume that means that the pharmaceutical companies are interested in getting those back, selling to the countries that can pay.
I agree with you. A lot of money, they would argue, went into research. Some of that money, by the way, was public money. Mm-hmm. But capitalism only does patronage and humanitarianism when it can profit from it, or when it has got its profit. So in this particular case, is that those countries, which were the wealthiest countries, and which could pay, as you rightly said, the roughly $15 to $60 a dose initially, were the countries that got the most vaccine. Countries which couldn't pay for those vaccines, especially the Pfizer and the AstraZeneca vaccine initially, at the back of the line. There were also cases of really price differentials. The AstraZeneca and Oxford vaccine was ought to South Africa at a far much more higher rate than it was sold to Britain. And unfortunately for South Africa, it turned out that vaccine did not work out, even though they paid a much more higher price than the British.
Okay, so we're in the middle of painting an incredibly grim picture here. Rashid, what about solutions? Do you see a way out?
So one of the ways out of this is, thankfully, there are a basket of vaccines available. The efficacy of those vaccines vary. So the Russians have the Sputnik vaccine, the Chinese have a vaccine that has a particular level of efficacy. Johnson & Johnson has also come out with a vaccine that is less efficacious. So the sense is, within the next couple of months, we do have a basket of vaccines to work with. So there is a little more choice, and developing countries, and also as well as developed countries, would have to look into diversifying or looking at those basket of vaccines, rather than saying that what we're going to do is just focus on really the two prominent vaccines. I think the Cubans also have a vaccine that they worked on. The second solution really is ramping up production. And this is where incentives, support must go from wealthier countries. If you have more doses that are available, is quote unquote, developed countries, can be seen or would be more inclined to be generous so that those vaccines can spread around. So just simply putting more resources into ramping up production. And the United States has a lot of resources and it can do that. Canada can also put in more resources. The European countries can put in more resources. The Chinese can put in more resources to ramp on production. The third area where real work needs to be done is access, is getting these vaccines to developing countries and making sure that they get into the arms of people. So the vaccine availability is one thing, but one of the big challenges that you have in Africa is not so much vaccine uptake or vaccine hesitancy. All indications are that the majority of Africans will take those vaccines. The question is getting those vaccines to where they need to get.
Distribution.
distribution. So the Pfizer and AstraZeneca vaccines will be very, very difficult because of the technology that they need to move them from one place to the other.
Is that the
they need to be stored. They need to be stored very, very low temperatures. The other vaccines can move around a little more, but it's just getting support to developing countries so that they can move from the factories to the countries, to the various dispensing agencies and hospitals, and they can get to people in many parts of the developing world outside the main cities.
What about a made in Africa solution? I mean, Egypt, Kenya, Morocco, and South Africa, they all have well-developed pharmaceutical industries. Is there any possibility for continental production?
Okay, so I thought we're not going there. So you hit on a very, important issue. I remember a colleague that you know very well, Ibrahim Abdallah, and I was discussing this about what was going on and what he called with regards access to the vaccine, what he called Northern power or vaccine capitalism. And one of the issues that came up was that, you know, this just exposes very badly the situation in Africa. At this particular point in time, given all of the continents, is that at this point, Africa is the only continent where you don't have production facilities for any COVID vaccine. They're producing in South America through Brazil, they're producing in Euro-Asia, we know that they're producing in North America. Africa is where you potentially have the capacity, but even in an economic like South Africa, you are not producing vaccine. So you're right, that one way out of this is really just to rev up and support production within the continent. And these are things that the big pharma can do. That is, they can support the pharmaceutical production facilities in the countries that you've mentioned to actually produce the vaccines.
Well, they can, but will they?
You know the challenge. This is that the question that they're going to ask: can we produce it to meet our bottom line in the continent? And if they can answer that particular question, I think they would be inclined to do that. But I don't think that they, at this particular point, I don't see any inclination now to do it immediately, because they would need to put resources into the factory, into these different factories to upgrade some of these factories. They would have to put resources in terms of moving around the inputs into making the vaccine. They would have to put money into training people to produce the vaccine. And they would also have to put in money to help beef up the infrastructure to develop, to deliver the vaccine. I don't think that at a time when they're probably making a killing, sorry for the pun, that they would be inclined to make that investment now.
Okay, so let's broaden it out for our last question. So we're in the middle of a huge chapter with this pandemic, and what we're seeing is a situation where Africa as a continent is wholly reliant on external sources of a very expensive vaccine. Multilateral efforts through the COVAX initiative are being undermined by countries like Canada, and in any event, with the 600 million doses that it was prepared to make available to Africa, that only represents vaccinating about 20% of Africans if all were to go perfectly. And I think the Centers for Disease Control in Africa are saying there has to be 60% immunization for there to be any chance of herd immunity. So not looking good. But in particular, in terms of what's the aftermath of this going to look like? Greater indebtedness, greater marginalization, a disease that's going to continue to wave across Africa longer than elsewhere. You know, all the contradictions of these neocolonial economies and global economy is it strengthening those structures? Is this episode going to ultimately strengthen the system in place, or is there some possibility of change when people see this deep, deep inequity?
So for every challenges, as you rightly laid out, there can also be sets of opportunities. Based on the last program, one of the sets of opportunities that we discussed is the impact of COVID, at least at the level of epidemiology and the level of impact on public health, has been less than in many parts of the world. And some of it has been because of not only inbuilt demographic advantages, but also built on the kind of popular and social mobilization that has taken place in terms of responding to the disease. So there is an opportunity there for people in the continent to think that we do have resources to think about and to respond to diseases, maybe not solely based on Western biomedicine. It's not that Western biomedicine is not important. It is important, but disease is not simply about medicine. It's also about how society responds to that. So I think they can chalk that as an opportunity. Another opportunity that is available is, as we've just discussed, the disease has revealed the deep, unequal distribution of power across the world. But we're also living in a time where the continent does not have to be trapped into the sort of old structures of where it's marginalized and it's a proxy for competing power. The fact that you have a lot of players, rather than historically the few players that you have, means that there is an opportunity for the continent to see how do we position ourselves not to become proxy, not to become marginal in this game, is to a way in which they can say, well, where are our strengths and how can we bring that to bear in the international scene. So it doesn't mean, that means that just as we've seen in terms of the opening up of opportunities for resources, not only from China, from India, from other places, without being strongly tied to one place, the continent can also look at that and say that there is an opening here. The United States is not coming out. United States want to come out of this pandemic, probably being an hegemonic power as it was. I don't think it is going to be. I don't think that China is necessarily going to come out winning the game. So there are a lot more players here. Africa does not need to be trapped into the kind of game that it was trapped during the Cold War period. So I think that there is an opportunity there in a much more fluid and in a much more open and in a much more dynamic international arena.
We're going to end on that note because it's positive, and Ismail Rashid, as usual, so helpful and enlightening to talk to you about these issues. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Gwen, and thank you very much. And my best wishes to Amanda, as always. Weather of pain, weather of legacy.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was our interview with Rashid about vaccine nationalism. We're here at Amandla Radio on CKUT 90.3 on your dial in Montreal. Now we're moving on to Gwen. You have another piece, this time by Feroz, about COVID-19 in Africa.
That's right. So we, Feroz Manji of Diraja Press recently returned to his series called Organizing in the Time of COVID. He'd taken a little bit of a break, but he is back with an absolutely fascinating interview with Dr. Renee Lowenson, who's a Zimbabwean epidemiologist. She has a long history of working on health issues with Zimbabwean trade unions and Africa-wide trade union organizations. She's also the founding member of Equinet, which is the regional network for equity in health in East and Southern Africa. And they address the question, what do we know about COVID-19 spread in Africa? You know, there's been a lot that's come out. Originally, in the very early days of the pandemic, the predictions were dire that this virus was going to tear through Africa and, you know, destroy it. And then lo and behold, that didn't happen. And then there was this very facile kind of, oh, well, you know, sort of all kinds of very simple reasons as to why somehow Africa didn't seem to be suffering it nearly as badly as the rest of the world. Now, of course, the explanations for this in Africa's experience are far more nuanced and complex than that. And in this conversation, a lot comes out about that. We're only playing 20 minutes tonight. It's a 1-hour conversation, and I strongly urge you to listen to the rest of it on the Diraja Press website. But for now, here's Feroz Manji in conversation with Dr. Renee Lowenson.
If one looks at the sort of mass media, the corporate media, what we've been fed is a story of, oh, you know, Afro's going to be torn apart, destroyed, and so on by COVID. There's an emergency that's required. And then a few weeks later, we get a whole series of stuff published, some of it from Africans themselves, about an essentialization of Africa. That, you know, well, you know, Africans are not getting the disease. They're immune to COVID-19. And you know, so we don't need to worry. So you've had these two contrasting aspects. So what really is going on? What do we know about COVID-19 across Africa?
Okay, that's a huge question. And Africa is a huge continent. And people tend to talk about Africa as though it's a country. But it's made up of very diverse situations. From experiences from North Africa, East Africa, Southern Africa, West Africa vary quite significantly. And even within the regions, there is quite big variation within these different sub-regions. And even within countries, there are micro-epidemics and micro-pandemics, if you can call it that way, that are taking place. So one lesson is not to overgeneralize about our continent. You know, having said that, I think that certainly speaking for East Africa and Southern Africa, we have a lot of movement of people and a lot of interaction between the countries of the region. So that what happens in one country is important for the other countries in the region. Our public health futures as a region are quite deeply linked. And part of that is because of the experiences of colonialism and the way countries are engaging in globalization, that we are experiencing some convergence around that as well. So I think it's some of this is about teasing out where we're different and also looking at what is underlying it that's actually in common. In speaking about the pandemic, I think I heard a WHO Afro reporting last week that there were 3.5 million cases on the continent and 88,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic. And that probably North Africa and Southern Africa are more affected than East Africa. And even within Southern Africa, that there are, you know, experiences like South Africa has been more affected. That countries that are more globally integrated, like Kenya, through travel hubs like Nairobi or Johannesburg, certainly had a much bigger experience of first wave pandemic. We've had, in 2020, there was a wave of the pandemic. In late 2020 to early 2021, there's now been a second wave of the pandemic. But let me come to your question. I mean, this notion that either, you know, Africa is the continent where everything goes bad. Therefore, you know, people were predicting dire scenarios and then thoroughly confused when it didn't happen and looking for explanations is part of this treatment of Africa as a source of all problems. As an emergency situation in and of itself is just part of this global stereotype, sensational media stereotype. But it's a mixed situation. So we don't know, we don't really have a good proven explanation as to why the case levels in Africa in terms of severe infection or mortality have been lower, and they have been lower. But there's a number of explanations. I mean, African countries certainly were faster in reacting to the closure of borders and the importation of cases than many other countries globally, including, by the way, countries that scored much higher than many of the countries in our region on the capacity assessments in the international health regulations reviews. African countries have had prior experience of pandemics and Ebola, et cetera. More rapid responses on surveillance and on the measures required. So I think there's been a sort of a quicker state response on the early measures that stopped some of the early local transmission. And as I said, some of the countries are not as embedded in global travel hubs and so on that allowed migration in of the virus. But it's true, we have a more youthful population in the continent. And there's some talk about sort of higher exposures due to, I mean, high exposures to other viruses and bacterial infections creating a more effective immune response in the population. I mean, there's a lot of different explanations around this, none of which I've seen properly validated. But I think we have to also recognize that the testing levels in the continent are lower than some of the other settings in other regions. I think WHO report that the normal desirable level should be about 10 tests per 1,000 population, and that about 20 countries in the region, in the continent, don't reach that, and many other countries are just above it. And I think we're seeing the effect of that in that we're really probably not picking up the cases that are taking place, or we're picking them up in a very variable way. And by the way, the reason the testing levels are very low is because we can't access the reagents. We don't access the reagents because of the patenting systems that are, you know, that we become importers of these things. The costs are high, et cetera, which is part of the reason for your very good interview last week around the TRIPS waiver, why we need this TRIPS waiver. Because there's no question we need to produce locally, given this competition that exists. So I think we're not detecting all of the cases. But it's more important that if we're not testing, we're also not picking them up to prevent the transmission and the pandemic spread. So, and the other thing is, I'm not sure whether we're detecting all the deaths. There might be, you know, we already have a high background level of respiratory problems, pneumonias, etc. So until we know what the excess deaths are, it'll be very difficult to understand how far this pandemic has really affected mortality in the region.
But that's a question I wanted to pose to you. I mean, yes, and that is, why is it so difficult to get data on excess deaths? I mean, when people die, especially in the urban centers, in the ghettos, and so on of our cities, there's only one way. I mean, they are registered. They are taken to the mortuaries and so on. So, I mean, surely there's data available on excess deaths. I mean, it's a crude measure, but at least we'll give you some idea of the impact of the pandemic.
I think it will come out in time. I mean, it's just the case that in many countries in the region, the registration and reporting of this is not as rapid as it is elsewhere. I think the one country that reports to the human mortality database or these international databases is South Africa, because the Medical Research Council is actively gathering and reporting this information. In other countries, it's sitting on paper records, and you know, there's a whole issue about how this gets turned over, reported. It's not just mortality data that gets reported late. I was looking on the international databases, the WHO databases, to see the reporting of pneumonias or of a life expectancy. It's all out of date. I mean, it's all 2018, even the World Bank databases, 2018. So we just don't have recent data put in public domain in our countries. It may well come out over time, and it's certainly something that we should be collecting. I mean, the other thing is that I think that we put a lot of attention on birth registration because it was so critical for many, many issues, for knowing, for catching, for immunization, for child health, etc. I'm not sure we've had as much attention around death registration as on birth registration. So my understanding is that it's still not as universally covered in terms of the formal registration systems as birth registration in our region.
So, as you pointed out, there is it's a very diverse continent with very different situations, both politically and economically, in different parts. So it's difficult to make generalizations, but it might be helpful to get some understanding of where do you think there's been good practice in terms of trying to deal with the pandemic. Are there good examples that, okay, they may not be perfect, but which give an indication of the seriousness with which our governments are taking the pandemic?
I think there's a fair amount of good practice. I hope we'll come back to this question about the impact on our countries and on our populations, though, because I think we tend to focus a lot on data on COVID, but actually the impact in our region goes well beyond the virus and its particular behaviors and its morbidity and mortality impact. I think I'm raising this because I think it comes to your question about where has there been good practice, is that there is a massive health debt growing in other areas. There is an economic debt growing at household level and at national level. There are long-term issues. I mean, there are issues about youth mental health and stress about, I think we have a public health emergency that goes well beyond the number of cases of COVID that we're going to have to deal with as a result of the pandemic. But to look then at sort of the good practices. So in all of the experiences that I'm aware of, I think that what we're seeing is a kind of a, not just the state, but a state-public interaction, that the positive practices are about a cooperation between the state and the public. And I think you can't talk about state practice around public health without talking about the public. So they've happened at different levels. At local level, we've seen cooperation between local governments and civil society and communities in a number of different ways. So I think there have been stories about the role of community health workers, of village health teams in Uganda, of local community groups organizing, of civil society organizing around the return of migrants, around helping people use services, around spreading information about uptake of testing, about support for food supplies, solidarity support, etc. And I think a lot of these local action networks, where they've worked well, have worked better because they get into a positive interaction with their local governments. That isn't always the case. In some cases, the local systems might see community organizing as a threat. But I think we have enough stories from different parts of the region to say that there have been this kind of local interactions that have worked well. And also, I think we've got experiences of local people organizing to create communication channels. I think in Senegal, there's a really interesting app called Suna City about how people can report issues to their local authority, but also get information from their local authority. We've got examples from some countries in different parts of Africa where communities are making masks and personal protective equipment for health workers, for local government health workers. So there's a lot of that kind of energy, but I think we've also had national level responses. So I talked about that a little bit earlier, where states have leveraged the learning from other pandemics to come in quickly and protect their population through surveillance or port health measures and so on. I think in our region, in Southern Africa, Eastern Southern Africa, for example, we've seen that in Uganda, in Mauritius, there was an incredible program of very widespread local information, outreach to households, detecting cases, testing. They've had very low levels of the pandemic as a result. I understand Kenya, there were measures to recruit health workers and reduce VAT and income tax. And I heard, and I'm not sure about this, but I was told that some members of the national executive even took a salary reduction. Human rights organizations have been engaging with states. We learned of the story from Ivory Coast, where human rights organizations engaged the Ministry of Justice around COVID in the prisons and began and worked with them on a prevention program and also on decongesting the prisons by early release and so on. So there's these sort of interfaces, but I think we've also seen it at regional level. I was really impressed when I read the stories about how, when the UK variant was discovered, how European borders closed to UK cargo traffic, and there was this massive buildup of cargo. And I thought about how the East African countries had, way back in 2020, developed a regional COVID PCR testing approach where it was on your smartphone. So drivers could cross borders across the whole region without having to have individual testing. These were things that had kind of been thought about because of earlier experiences of pandemics that were put in place much more quickly than higher income countries. Or the current work that the Africa CDC is doing to share genomic testing capacities in Africa to build laboratories so that they can improve genomic surveillance of new variants. Or there have been coordinated strategies to procure reagents and medicines and now vaccines. And I heard last week that ECOWAS is setting up a measure to do price controls on PCR testing because there's this rampant price variation in the price sector around something that people want. And it's another barrier to testing, by the way, is that who can afford to pay $50 to $60 for a PCR test, for a test for this? So I think there's quite a lot that's been going on. What's been really impressive for me, is where this cooperation has kind of strengthened the global engagement. And I think we saw a little bit of it in the World Health Assembly last year. Hopefully we'll see more of it, and more so now in the TRIPS waiver organization, where I think civil society and governments are pulling together around it. So I think there's this cooperation, but I mean, we are engaging essentially with structural factors that are causing inequalities globally, nationally, locally. And we're trying to do it with states that are under invested in all the key areas that we need because of the neoliberal economies, in housing, in transport systems, in social protection systems, in health systems, in public health, in primary health care, in food security. All of these things have been problematic because of decades of underinvestment, because of first structural adjustment and then the neoliberal economies. And it's interesting, I've been reading some recent literature that suggests that countries that have less, that have been affected less economically from the pandemic, are those that are more diversified and more locally integrated. Countries that are more globally integrated, that are exporting their products more, have been significantly more affected by these supply chain problems and export problems, and you know, those that are exporting minerals, etc. But there's something about the path we took away from our own kind of inclusive economies towards this neoliberal economic approach that has a very had a very damaging impact in COVID. So it'd be very interesting to see how much we can find out more about this and really explore it. We already showed it was damaging for food security and nutrition. Now it's kind of showing another lesson of this around COVID.
So that was a conversation between Feroz Manji of Diraja Press and Dr. Renee Lowenson. Again, I encourage you to listen to the rest of it on the just directly off of the Diraja Press website. And while we're talking about Feroz Manji, we are really thrilled to be able to tell you that Feroz has been awarded the 2021 Nicolas Cristobal Guillen Batista Lifetime Achievement Award of the Caribbean Philosophical Association. So this award is given annually for contributions to philosophical thought, literature, and mentorship. And our own Feroz Manji, well, I'm claiming him as our own, but he's not, but a good friend of Amandla, regular contributor, and just a good friend, period, won the award. We are so thrilled. It is quite the distinction. So bravo, Feroz Manji, and thank you so much for all the wonderful work that you do and all of the knowledge that you help bring to us.
That's it, Gwen. Thanks a lot. Feroz certainly does deserve a prize like that. He has an amazing background, and we appreciate his contributions to the show. And ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this week with Amandla. We will be back again next week with more news and analysis from the continent of Africa. Stay safe, stay secure, and we'll stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
such a thing.
We all may go on.
We're gonna exterminate you now. We will get our power.
We all may go on. We are a superior being.
Daleks, listen to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.